Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Since the beginning of this century, the term American exceptionalism has become a loaded political weapon. Politicians pay rhetorical fealty to the phrase, and today it carries with it baggage of nationalism and xenophobia, as well as the singular nature of the United States, as a democracy and place where many diverse people become one. My guest, though, says to accurately describe American exceptionalism today, it's more of the former than the latter. Mugambi Jue of Stanford Law School says Americans today are more divided than other Westerners on many basic rights, from health care, gun control, gender roles, and abortion, to climate change, wealth inequality, mass incarceration, and war. This divide between Americans and between Americans and the rest of liberal democracy is perhaps the best definition of American exceptionalism. Professor Jue is the author of Exceptional America, What Divides Americans from the World and from Each Other. It's published by the University of California Press and examines these divisions and the forces that have led to the ascendancy of the Trump presidency. Jue is a Thomas Gray Fellow at Stanford Law School and a human rights lawyer. His writing has been featured at Mother Jones, Slate, The New Republic, The San Francisco Chronicle, and The Huffington Post. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Mugambi Jue, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Your book examines the meaning and reality of American exceptionalism and the divide that seems to exist politically, socially, and culturally between Americans and also the rest of the world, especially the democratic world. Let's begin with this idea of American exceptionalism. This whole concept has become sort of a rhetorical weapon within the last decade or so. But what does it mean today?
It's need to become a rhetorical weapon because, as I document in my book, the references to the term exploded in the U.S. media around the time Obama was elected because leaders of the Republican establishment recurrently accuse him of not believing in American exceptionalism and aiming to transform America into Europe with his socialist agenda. But historically, American exceptionalism has meant something else. Most people today think it means a faith in American superiority, exceptional in the sense of phenomenal or outstanding. But historically, it's primarily meant that America is an exception, objectively and descriptively, especially compared to other Western democracies. For example, today America is the only Western democracy to still have the death penalty and the only one to lack a universal health care system. And these are dimensions of what American exceptionalism has historically meant, but they are not inherently good or bad. It depends on what people think of the death penalty and universal health care. In my book, I argue that the extraordinary polarization of modern American society is a dimension of what American exceptionalism truly means.
This idea, I don't think most people would determine it as, you know, still having the death penalty or no universal health care. They would think of it as like the image that was evoked during Reagan's presidency of the shining city on the hill, this beacon of democracy. Now, I think you can look objectively at the events of the last about 20 years and you say, well, maybe not so exemplary, at least in how we've dealt with the post 9/11 world. But for a lot of Americans, do you think they still see America in those sorts of terms?
Yes. Americans today tend to be much more patriotic or nationalistic than other Westerners, that is, Europeans, Canadians, Australians, and New Zealanders. And ideas about American superiority or America being a special country chosen by God to be a beacon of light to the world have essentially existed ever since Europeans set foot in North America and since the founding era later on. But these ideas were not called by the precise phrase American exceptionalism. Interestingly, most scholars trace the origins, if not the coinage of that phrase in modern language, to American communists. We used it in the 1920s to argue that America is an exception and that the so-called universal laws of Marxism would have to evolve differently in America because of its distinct set of economic and social conditions. And later, the phrase was mainly used by academics, who analyzed how America is an exception, objectively and descriptively, in a number of areas like law, history, etc. And it was not before, like I mentioned, the Obama presidency that the term became widely used and was a rhetorical weapon equating a belief in American superiority. But historically, that's not what it's meant.
And of course, over the history of our culture, we've been far more diverse than most other Western democracies, perhaps until recently, where you have, even going back to colonial days, you know, you had Englishmen, you had Dutch, you had Germans coming into Pennsylvania. You had a variety of opinions about how this young democracy should work as opposed to a very monolithic European country, just in comparing it to Western Europe.
In relative terms, America has been far more diverse demographically than other Western democracies throughout its history. Even among Americans of European descent, as you noted, there's a lot of diversity in terms of their origins in England, Ireland, Italy, and beyond. And also, America has historically been the Western democracy with by far the biggest share of racial and ethnic minorities that has also shaped American history in many different ways, from the Civil War being in large part a divide over slavery and the status of African Americans, to the Civil Rights Movement. And today, we see that racial issues are also part of the cocktail that makes America a very polarized country.
In fact, you write, it says, you know, when you look at exceptionalism, perhaps what is exceptional about America is how divided Americans are in their core values compared to other Western democracies.
Yes. Americans tend to routinely clash over a broad range of issues that are either not controversial or much less controversial elsewhere in the modern Western world, such as universal health care, gun control, abortion, contraception, or whether climate change is a scientific reality or a hoax. These types of issues, leaving aside a few exceptions like abortion in Ireland and Poland, are not divisive or much less divisive elsewhere in the Western world, and they help explain why American society is very polarized over a host of really fundamental questions.
And those fundamental questions, you know, they range from, you mentioned climate change, but, you know, election spending, you know, all sorts of what you would say fundamental issues of governance. There seems to be two very different views, and we've seen this here in just within the last election and prior to the Obama presidency and the Bush presidency. We seem to be, this pendulum seems to be swinging wildly back and forth.
Yes, this is a long-term phenomenon that started well before the Trump presidency. For example, America is the Western nation where moneyed interests have by far the biggest influence over the democratic process in terms of lobbying and financing elections. And that also tends to shape unique dimensions of American society or play a role in that, such as the absence of universal health care, tremendous resistance in parts of the country towards environmental regulation, which is partly promoted by polluting industries, which fund pseudoscientific studies and claim that climate change is a hoax. But because they have significant influence over the political process in America, and much more so than other Western nations, they can shape U.S. policy to a greater extent.
Yeah. Now, one of the things you, in tracking this idea of how divided Americans are in their core values, you look at our politics. Are we as Americans as polarized as our politicians seem to be?
That's the main, or one of the main areas of debate among experts, whether polarization is mainly at the level of politicians or also at the level of the average citizen. In my book, I argue that it's both, that even though it seems to be clear that politicians play a major role in driving polarization, the public also is very polarized over a broad range of issues. For example, over whether people should have basic rights to health care or whether women should have a basic right to abortion at their discretion. These types of issues are very divisive and also explosive issues in American society.
Well, as we get into some of the aspects of this sort of exceptional America you're writing about in your book, people can have views, but actually if you show that there's an interesting piece of research where it's looking at income inequality, and statements from the participants that they felt like, you know, America was the embodiment of the American dream, that anybody can make it. But when they actually showed them charts of ways in which government provides social service nets, and you don't put the names of the countries, they preferred Sweden over Americans by a 2-3-4-1 margin.
There's a study that I cited in my book where people were shown different pie charts with the degree of wealth distribution in a number of different countries, but the names of the countries were hidden. And indeed, most Americans preferred the Swedish level of wealth distribution than the one in the U.S., which is much less equal, and America being the least equal country in the West in terms of wealth, and also not doing as well than many other countries in regard to economic mobility. But at the same time, many citizens are not aware of that. For example, with regard to the debate over universal health care, many of the citizens who are vehemently opposed to the creation of a universal health care system in the U.S. have been persuaded, in large part by politicians and other special interests, that other Westerners live under the tyranny of socialized medicine, and that other Westerners have much less access to health care, even though the exact opposite is true, and also that other Westerners spend much, much more on health care than Americans do. And again, the precise opposite is true. Overall, Americans spend much more for a healthcare system that covers far fewer people.
So, and this gives rise to another part of your book, which looks at anti-intellectualism and also the rise of political demagogy and propaganda to influence public opinion. So I want to get back to this question of whether Americans are polarized as politicians. Do you think politicians are reflecting the polarization of Americans?
Both. I would say, based on my research, that the views of politicians and the views of the general public have been shaped by unique dimensions of American history, culture, politics, law, economic attitudes, religious beliefs, race relations, and so forth. And that helps explain why the country is so divided.
My guest today is Mugambi Jue, a Thomas Gray Fellow at Stanford Law School and a human rights lawyer. He's the author of Exceptional America, What Divides Americans from the World and Each Other. It's published by the University of California Press. Let's talk a little bit about anti-intellectualism. You grew up in Paris, but you came to the United States when you came to college at Rice University. And you said you were really struck by, even within a prestigious American university like Rice, the amount of anti-intellectualism, and it wasn't really ignorance, but it was also seeing education as simply vocational. How do you think this has affected public discourse?
Yes, it's important to understand that anti-intellectualism does not mean stupidity or even a lack of education. Rather, it's a peculiar conception of education that is skeptical of knowledge that does not seem to have a practical purpose. That is the most common form of anti-intellectualism, and that's even present in great academic institutions among people who are well accomplished, and they don't necessarily value intellectual curiosity. Of course, there are many contradictions and tensions within American society, so many citizens do value intellectual curiosity and learning for its own sake as well. That's important to note. But anti-intellectualism also can be more intense in other areas, such as in fostering downright hostility towards the learned among some citizens, or in fostering receptiveness to conspiracy theories and propaganda, or disinformation, which is the deliberate spread of false information for political reasons. And that plays a much bigger role in the U.S. political and legal debate than in other Western nations. Even far-right European parties, even though they take hard-line stances, are less inclined to resort to routine conspiracy theories than many American politicians do. That long preceded the rise of Donald Trump, the weight of anti-intellectualism. It has roots in some dimensions of the birth of American democracy that we could talk about as well. But it's striking to see the type of rhetoric in the U.S. compared to other Western nations today. For example, Donald Trump having suggested that Obama is not really an American citizen because he has a forged U.S. birth certificate, or having claimed that climate change is a hoax promoted by the Chinese. This type of rhetoric is very peculiar by international standards.
But aren't you seeing a rise of that sort of demagogy and propaganda in some of these Western democracies? I mean, if you look at the French election, if you look at the Brexit election, if you look at some of the ongoing elections in continental Europe, aren't you seeing a rise of this sort of disinformation within the campaign rhetoric?
There is definitely a rise of demagoguery and very hardline anti-immigrant, far-right sentiment in parts of Europe. However, that's different from simply conspiracy theories. That is less used by even far-right parties in Europe. And one example is Marine Le Pen, who is the leader of the French far-right. Actually, she became more popular in recent years, partly by sanitizing her rhetoric and making herself seem more reasonable and using more what are called dog whistle messages, which are basically coded language to appeal to sympathizers. And she actually supported the expulsion of her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, who was known as the founder of the far-right French party and was known for very hardline, very explosive, provocative, incendiary rhetoric. And therefore, the French far-right has normalized itself by sanitizing its rhetoric, whereas in the U.S. we see an opposite trend where Donald Trump was elected after using routinely provocative, inflammatory language and conspiracy theories.
Does this, you know, what's happening in the United States today, does it get back to this sort of fear of government? You know, I'm always struck by, there's a website that actually will take onion stories and put them up as Facebook posts and, you know, it satirizes the people that take them serious. But what's really funny is anytime there's an onion story, this is a satirical website that will put out the most ridiculous fact and say it's a government study, it's like people are 10 times more likely to buy into it and make comments. I'm wondering if this is just sort of a fundamental trend of American political life. Is this fundamental mistrust of government?
It depends on which parts of the country. Yeah. This is one of the issues that tends to polarize Americans the most. Many Americans that would want the government to play a more active role in, say, reducing wealth inequality or establishing a universal health care system, if not strengthening environmental regulations. But for many other citizens, the government is at the root of all economic and social problems, and they really favor eviscerating practically all forms of regulations and taxation. And we see that this has played a role also in the current political climate and the election of Mr. Trump, because even though on some levels he supported Social Security, at least in his rhetoric, on another level he painted the image of a haywire federal government under Barack Obama that was oppressing the American people. And many people who flocked Mr. Trump were people who actually would have benefited did benefit from some of the policies instituted by Barack Obama.
Now, one of your sections of the book, which probably would, if you took a quick read, it would be the headline of a propagandized version against your book, is this idea that that belief in the American dream does drive the country further apart. And it gets sort of to the heart of what we've been talking about, is this idea that the American dream is about rising by your bootstraps with no help from anybody else. And yes, that is possible. But when you look at statistics, we're less socially mobile, economically mobile, than even a lot of higher regulated governments. And you said that really plays a role in this sort of distrust of government.
Yes, the American dream can be a source of inspiration for people aiming to rise up from poverty, but also it can be a very divisive national ideal because today American liberals and conservatives have radically opposite conceptions of how to fulfill the American dream. Liberals tend to again foresee a government playing a more active role in reducing wealth inequality, and conservatives tend to think that the main obstacle to the American dream is a government intervention and overreaching in the American economy. At the same time, if we look at international data, we see that there's less social mobility in America than in many Western European nations, and America does not stand out because of the possibility of fulfilling the American dream. Rather, what stands out is the belief in the American dream, especially the notion that America is a country chosen by God to be a beacon of light to the world, and therefore it's possible to achieve anything in America, but not in other Western nations.
Also, you look at all sorts of other issues, a couple of which I found interesting because I really think of these forces diminishing, and that would be Christian fundamentalism and the culture wars. And in fact, if anything, I just see these forces as being diminishing forces. And I think towards the end of the book, you actually say, I'm not in the business of predicting the future. It could be that this current phase, this current administration is reflective of sort of a last gasp of this economic far-right populism that President Trump seems to represent. But you, I think, in at least in those two sections where you're talking about fundamentalism and cultural wars, you don't see that as diminishing, do you?
So there may be a generational replacement in the sense that younger Americans, even though many of them still are believers in Christianity, they are less drawn towards more fundamentalist conceptions of the faith. And, for example, appear more tolerant on issues like gay rights. And that may signal that over the long term, it will be hard for the religious right as a political movement. At the same time, Christian fundamentalism has a huge influence in American society as a whole. Between a third and 40% of Americans are creationists who believe that human beings were created by God in their present form and that the theory of evolution is false. A similar proportion believe in apocalyptic biblical prophecies about the second coming of Christ. These types of beliefs are very atypical by international standards, except within the United States. And in America, they're mainly concentrated among conservative citizens. And we see that also politically, the religious right has played a significant role in the election of Donald Trump, supporting his candidacy. And Mike Pence is a proponent of intelligent design, which is a rebranding of creationism under another name for strategic and legal reasons. And the culture wars are likely to continue in many ways because, for example, there still are many efforts to undermine Planned Parenthood or to put an end to abortion as a constitutional right, which was one of the reasons based on the available evidence, why Neil Gorsuch was supporters of the Trump administration as candidate for the Supreme Court. Now, of course, we don't know how he's going to rule, but at least there's strong reason to believe that he was picked in part because he would be skeptical of a constitutional right to abortion.
Now, you do say that Christian fundamentalism, along with another brand of fundamentalism, economic fundamentalism, sort of work hand in hand, which you see a lot of non-college educated voters, small-town voters, that will vote against their own economic interests. This was sort of the premise of what's the matter with Kansas. But you say it's far a little more complex than what he was talking about, where your social conservatism sort of trumps your economic. And you say that's actually a brand where those work hand in hand.
Yes. Overall, based on the available data, it appears that economic issues actually have more importance than cultural war issues and how people vote. But religious beliefs can also shape attitudes towards economic matters, especially for people who lean towards Christian fundamentalism, because that shapes a hardline, anti-rational, black and white mindset that extends beyond theological questions or social policy matters like abortion, contraception, and gay rights. And looking at the data and also at the political discourse, we see that many of the citizens who are Christian fundamentalists also are often market fundamentalists. That is, they believe that big government, taxes, and regulation are the causes of virtually all economic problems. And that's because, in part, there's a connection in how they think about religion and the economy in stressing ideological purity.
And where does that go down the road?
Well, it's hard to make predictions, but as I mentioned, there are different potential scenarios here. On one hand, there appear to be periods of greater liberalism and conservatism in American history, just like there are periods of greater polarization or lesser polarization. And it's possible that over long term, Americans will become less divided over these issues. But fundamentally, here, the major source of the divide is not only that there's a major degree of polarization on social values, but also there's a major factual divide on many of the questions that divide Americans today. For example, whether climate change is a hoax, whether voter fraud is rampant, whether having an unbridled right to bear arms makes a society safer, whether countries with universal health care spend a lot more money on health care than the U.S. does. Because there's such a major divide on a lot of these issues, it's hard to find common ground for solutions.
When you can't agree over the nature of what our facts are, doesn't that spell decline for society?
Or at least, I don't know if it necessarily spells decline, but it certainly does not spell progress.
Do you have any suggestions for how we can actually at least begin to agree on what facts are?
In general, it's important for all people, I would say, to make an effort to learn about many different fields, to travel to different parts of the country and the world, to have a broad-minded perspective, to meet people from different backgrounds, and that is not only racially or ethnically or religion-wise, but also people from other political leanings. And part of the issue here is that with partisan polarization comes a tendency to see opponents as bad people, to dehumanize them. But it's really important for Americans to still make an effort to befriend people from different backgrounds, of different political sensibilities, if the society is to become less balkanized.
You know, at one point in our country's history, we became so balkanized, we fought a huge conflict over it 150 years ago.
Yes, and that reflects the cycles of polarization in American history. Just like there have been cycles of polarization in the history of other Western nations, including France. But today, America really stands out in terms of the magnitude of polarization over a host of really fundamental questions.
The name of the book is Exceptional America. Mugambi Ajuwe, thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
The pleasure was all mine.
Mugambi Ajuwe is the Thomas Gray Fellow at the Stanford Law School and a human rights attorney. He's also the author of Exceptional America, What Divides Americans from the World and Each Other. It's published by the University of California Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.